As destructive as they are, plant diseases can be intriguing. So intriguing that our guest wrote a book about some of them using limericks. I'm Jill Nadeau. Thanks for joining us today. And who else but Dr. Death himself, Brian Huddleston, would write this fun little book. Brian is the director of the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic in the Department of Plant Pathology at UW-Madison. And he recently published this fanciful little book of limericks. They're based on common and uncommon plant diseases and fungi or fungi. Brian, welcome back.
Hi, Jill. How are you?
Thanks for having
me today.
So how do you pronounce F-U-N-G-I?
Fungi.
Fungi. Okay. Fungi. Well, I looked it up. Apparently, there are like three accepted pronunciations. So
you can pronounce it any way you like, as long as I understand what you're saying.
I don't care.
And that's a common problem when I'm dealing with talking about fungi that cause disease, because it's all Latin.
And so
you look at these words and it's like, how on earth do you pronounce these? So as long as I can figure out kind of what you're saying, it works okay.
Wonderful. Well, you've been with us on Garden Talk for a really long time, but you know what? I don't think we ever asked you, how did you get into plant pathology? What brought you to this?
I was interested in plants from an early age because my paternal grandparents had taken their yard. They lived in Normal, Illinois, and they had naturalized it. So I was exposed to wild plants forever and ever, and I found that really fascinating. And then when I got into high school, I originally kind of wanted to be an archaeologist, but I had a really, really good biology teacher who focused on plants. She loved plants. And in fact, I'm still in contact with her after all of these years. We do Zoom meetings about once a month. And she got me into plants and got me into doing research. And I actually started out in college as a botany major, took a bacteriology class to fulfill a requirement for that, and thought, oh, bacteriology is kind of fun. So I'll double major in botany and bacteriology. And then by the time I got done doing all the requirements for that, I was one course away from getting a molecular biology degree. So I picked that up. And it was like, okay, what do I want to do to kind of combine all of these things? And the logical area was plant pathology. So that's how I ended up in doing what I do now. And I love my job. I have the best job in the world, quite frankly.
We can tell you have a good job.
I love what I do. I get to see the craziest, funnest things in my lab.
I'm oohing
and eyeing over some photos this morning. Someone sent me of a rust disease on bellflower that I'd never seen before. So it's like, oh, wow, a new disease.
Well, that's great for you, not so much for the person sending it.
Although people understand I'm very eccentric. My nickname is Dr. Death. So they're quite tolerant of my going ooh and ah over plant diseases.
Okay, so I know the backstory of how the little book came into existence, but why don't you tell us where the inspiration came from?
Yeah, actually, the first time I dealt with limericks in a professional sense was about 30 years ago. Actually, I was director of what's called the UW Ginseng Research Program, and had a little downtime one day. The three of us who were on staff, it was myself and Ann Joy and Nancy Kurzweil, we came up with this limerick about a ginseng disease, and that has been taped to my incubator in my lab for about 30 years. And so when we kind of got into COVID, I was trying to think of ways that I could program a little bit differently. And primarily my demographic that I tend to interact with is an older demographic, so adult education. And so I was trying to think of a way of perhaps getting younger people interested in plant diseases. And I saw that limerick on my incubator and I thought, well, maybe limericks might be an in for doing that because they're kind of fun. They're kind of silly. And so that started me off writing this book. So it's called Limerickhetsia, which is a word mash. Actually, it's limerick and then rickhetsia, rickhetsia is a type of disease causing organism.
Yes. So. And it's difficult to say, by the way. Thank you, Brian.
Yeah, you're welcome.
I appreciate that. Tell them what it looks like, because I've got one here in my hands, and I was just surprised. It's really beautiful.
What I did was I wrote the limericks to start with, and then I decided, okay, I need more than that in the book than just the limericks. So it's kind of set up. The setup is on the left panel as you open the book is the limerick, and on the right panel, there's a prose description of the disease with information on, you know, the organisms that cause the disease and how to manage it. And there's some, for some of them, some historical information as well. And then I thought, okay, I need something hopefully pretty to look at so I could get photographs. So there's some photographs of the disease. And then I thought, okay, I want some artwork. And I actually did the artwork myself. It kind of frames the limerick, frames the prose descriptions. And I have to say, that was the most fun part of any of this, was that I'm not an artist and I was able to do this artwork. And I'm pretty proud of that, because like I said, I'm not an artist. So it turned out, I think, to look pretty good. And it's very colorful, which I think is important for this topic. Because we're talking about death and destruction here, a lot of kind of negative connotations, and you need something that's, you know, bright and colorful and makes it attractive when you look at it.
Well, Brian, I do have an art background, and I can tell you, you're an artist, whether you like to hear it or not.
Well,
you are.
If you want to know the truth, I really didn't have any art programs to do this in. So I did this in PowerPoint, which is a...
Oh my gosh. Wow.
So PowerPoint is pretty powerful in terms of what it can do artistically. So I was familiar with that program, having put together a lot of talks through the years. So it's just, I kind of experimented with that. Discovered some things down the road that I wish I had known about when I first started doing the art pieces, but it turned out pretty well. I'm pretty pleased with what happened.
What I love about this is, okay, you've got this beautiful color, but you've got to look at what it's made of, because it's got the disease itself is kind of worked into the frames.
Yep.
And so each one is different for each disease.
So they're all tailored to the particular disease that I'm writing the limericks about.
Yeah. What a fun book to give away, too. Great gift.
Yeah, I've given quite a few. And I have to say, I'm very grateful. I wanted to do all the photography myself as well, but I soon realized, given that some of the diseases I was talking about don't occur here in Wisconsin, and I have to go to places like Florida and California in order to try to get photos, and I might not ever get really good photos, that I was going to have to ask for help in terms of the photographs. And so I contacted a lot of colleagues and just some people that I didn't know at all and said, hey, I'm doing this really weird project. Would you allow me to use this photograph that I found that you've taken? And invariably, people were bought in and said, sure. And so if you go to the back of the book, there are a lot of photo credits for all the people who helped with the project.
I want to have you read one or two of these just to kind of give people a taste of what they'll see. Let's start with the tobacco rattle, which you've got on page 8.
Yeah, I have to say I really like the artwork on that one. That one that came out particularly well.
It's very pretty.
Yeah, so that particular one, it's on leaves of the fair bleeding heart, a virus that rattles does start. Like a bolt from afar or a famed wizard scar, it makes plant disease find modern art. And I love this particular disease because the symptoms are incredibly pretty. I see it on bleeding heart. I have a bleeding heart in my backyard that's infected with this virus, and it shows these lightning bolt like symptoms on the leaves. It's incredibly pretty, and that's where the famed wizard scar comes from. And
Yeah,
and if you didn't know it for sure, there are certain art parts of the art pieces that are specifically for plant disease geeks like me. So you can see the bleeding heart that's on there, but the little kind of pinkish bars that are on there, that's actually a diagram of the virus.
Oh.
And the little gray wiggles that you see there are actually tiny nematodes. And this particular virus is moved from plant to plant by these little worm-like organisms that are in the soil. So those are the nematodes.
You had way too much fun with this, Brian.
I did have a lot of fun with this. Indeed, I did.
Well, let's talk about this tobacco rattle virus a little bit. We have it here in Wisconsin.
Yes.
And is it something that we have to worry about, or is it just going to make our plant look pretty?
On ornamentals, I don't worry about it that much.
Okay.
But the reason it's such an important virus is because it not only goes to ornamentals, but also potatoes. And we have a huge potato industry here in the state. We're the third largest producer of potatoes in the U.S. And once it gets into the potatoes, it doesn't really cause leaf symptoms like it does on bleeding heart, but it'll get into the tubers and it causes little bits of the tuber tissue to die. So you get these kind of brown flecks in the tubers. And if you're growing chipping potatoes for making potato chips, when you slice those up and fry those potatoes with these little necrotic areas, you get black spots in your potato chips, which is not a good selling point.
No, not at all. Next one, I liked the blossom end rot, which, of course, we get lots of questions about on
right.
Garden Talk. So let's have you read that limerick.
Yeah. A tomato ensconced in a pot was never once watered a lot. Its low calcium rate drove it into a state where it suffered from blossom end rot. And again, that gives you some information about the problem here. It's not really a true disease. It's a lack of calcium in the plant that causes that particular problem.
And
we see this on tomatoes and peppers and any vegetable crop where you're eating the actual fruit, botanical fruit of the crop can potentially have blossom end rot.
Mm-hmm. And is that caused by not watering or watering it infrequently or something like that, right?
Yeah, the you can have either too little calcium in the soil, which is not usually a problem here in Wisconsin. We mm-hmm. have limestone as our bedrock, so we have plenty of calcium typically. But usually, as the plants go into flowering and producing fruits, if you're not watering them enough, you can't mobilize enough of that calcium in the soil to get it into the plants and into the fruits. So we really recommend making sure you're giving your plants, your tomatoes, a lot of water as they start to flower.
Mm-hmm. And where can you get it real quick?
Yeah, you can go to my clinic website, which is pddc.wisc.edu. And if you just scroll down that main page, there's a series of tabs towards the bottom of the page. And one of them says Limerickettsia book. And you can open that up. It gives you a link to a description of the book. And then that links you to an order form. And all of the proceeds for the book are going to support my clinic on campus.
Which is wonderful. And we do have a link on our program note today. So you just go to WPR.org/Larry and you will see that under this particular program. We're talking with Brian Huddleston about his book, Limerickettsia, a plant pathologist book of verse. Brian is director of the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic in the Department of Plant Pathology at UW-Madison. This is the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. And right now we are talking to Brian Huddleston, director of the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic in the Department of Plant Pathology at UW-Madison. He has published a fun little book on plant disease. It's called Limerickettsia, a Plant Pathologist Book of Verse. So what's the response been to your fellow pathologist?
The pathologists, plant pathologists they interact, they like the book. Of course, they're going to because that's their thing. sales are certainly not hopping, let me put it that way, but that really wasn't the point. In part, the project is just trying to find alternate ways to get people excited about plant diseases. From a personal standpoint, my paternal grandmother was an author. She wrote a lot of kids' poetry and games and was an author on one book. So there was kind of an impetus there for me to try to do something in the same vein. So, but I'm happy it's out and have been distributing them as I can.
Sure. So. Well, it may not be a New York Times bestseller, but I'm sure it'll be a classic.
Yeah. Well, I hope so. And I hope people find it useful as a teaching tool.
Again,
my goal was not only to just write a book, but have it educational as well, because that's kind of what I do.
Yeah. And, it's really nice because it's a fun way to learn about things. It's not painful
right.
at all. So.
No.
And it's one of those things where, pick one a day and you learn about the disease
right.
and you have a good time.
Yeah.
So so let's talk about a few more of the limericks. What about the one on needle cast? That's 24.
Yeah. And I'll explain how I actually came up with that one.
Okay.
Another eccentricity of mine. The overused blue and white spruce formed innermost needles of puce. Once a short time had passed, all these needles were cast and the trees became landscape abuse. And that one actually originated because for some reason, I really like the word puce. And I have since I was a little kid. And so it's like, okay, I want to use this word. And it made sense in the context of this disease because with the needle cast, I'm talking about rhizosphere needle cast. It's a fungal disease and it causes interior needles on spruce trees to turn this kind of purple color. So puce really fit in. And then the landscape abuse is because it makes the trees look so ugly. It doesn't kill them, but makes them look ugly enough that you kind of wish they were dead. So that was, I think, apropos as well. So,
oh, that's great. Well,
and we really do overuse blue and white spruce in our landscapes. So
we do. We do. It's funny that you like the word puce, because I like puce and chartreuse. Those are two of my favorite color names. So appreciate that, Brian. And we've got a caller, Barb in Blue Mounds. What question do you have?
Hi, can you hear me?
We can. Go ahead.
All right, super. My husband and I are debating about no-till gardening. I lay hay down every year and notice that what it's doing is causing new soil to be generated that seems really good and fresh. Last year, the tomatoes did not do well. They didn't produce. They grew, but they were spindly. Question we have is whether or not we should go back through and turn the soil, because the idea is that you don't, my understanding is the idea is that you don't disrupt the biome that's developed there. So we don't really understand how to then go back in and work the soil if we need to.
Yeah, I would say that there is definitely some information indicating that you get kind of these networks of fungi that develop in the soil if you leave it as no-till. Really, though, in order to plant properly, you may have to do at least a little minimal cultivation to get the material incorporated into the soil. And from a plant disease standpoint, really, sometimes you can run into some problems with no-till because you're leaving a lot of plant debris on the surface, which can be a place where disease-causing organisms can overwinter, survive, and then they'll sit there, and a lot of the pathogens are fungi, so they'll generate spores in that debris that can eventually infect new plants that you're planting in the area. So there is some benefit from a disease standpoint of burying that debris to get it to rot really quickly. But again, I understand what I would suggest would be to, if you really want to get the benefits of the no-till, would be to just put in plants where you need to. So dig holes and put them in. And then you probably want to mulch over the top of that. That covers up the debris, the old plant debris that you've left. And that'll provide a physical barrier to help prevent some of the spore movement from that debris into the air where it can blow around and get to your plants.
Okay, thank you for the question, Barb. And I know that last year a lot of people did have problems with tomatoes. We got a lot of calls and garden talk. So maybe it's just a fluke.
Yeah,
it's hard to say.
For me, from a plant disease standpoint, we see problems with tomatoes every year. In fact, one of the other limericks that you tagged that you liked was on one of the most common diseases that we see on tomatoes. So,
Okay, well, thank you, Barb. Well, I think we probably should read that since you kind of, you know, got people interested on it now. Which one was that?
Yeah, so if you've ever had tomato plants that defoliate from the bottom up, this limerick is for you. And that's pretty much everyone who has ever grown a tomato plant.
Right.
And the limerick is, on tomato leaves bottom to top, do noodle-like spores slyly drop. The plant's health is soon breached by small spots ringed and bleached. A tsunami of blight that won't stop. And that's a disease called septorial leaf spot. It's very common in home gardens. And the fungus is everywhere in the environment. And it does produce these noodly-like spores and tends to infect at the bottom of the plant first, where it's a little bit wetter. Fungal pathogens really like wetter conditions. And it will cause a lot of spotting to the point where the entire leaf will collapse, and that'll kind of move up the plant. The saving grace to this particular disease is that it does not infect or affect the fruits. So you do get at least some usable fruits from the plants, but you can end up with plants that have basically no foliage by the end of the growing season. And that will really, of course, reduce yield, how many tomatoes you get and how big they are.
I've had plants like that.
Yeah, most gardeners are. And there's not a lot you can do for that disease. We have a fact sheet on my website that talks about things you can try to do. But if we have the right summer weather, if it's particularly wet, you can do everything I have listed on that fact sheet and you'll still have problems.
Yeah. So. I have a picture up on our program note with the, what is it? Oh, bird's nest of fungi.
Yeah.
Why don't you talk a little about that? You were talking about mulch before and you can find it in mulch. It's really kind of cool.
it's the coolest little organism and the name is very descriptive. It's not a disease-causing organism. And it's just a fungus that tends to colonize mulch layers.
It's on 80 if you're looking for it, I think.
Yeah,
79.
Thank you.
79.
78, yeah. Okay. And the name is so descriptive because it looks, you'll take a look at your mulch and you'll see these little tiny things that look like little bird's nests with eggs inside. And they're actually fungal structures. The eggs are actually packets of spores. And they are ejected from the cup by raindrops. And so those splash them out. And then this little packet of spores will have a sticky kind of tendril that's attached to it. And as they get ejected out, eventually that tendril will stick to, say, a plant or something like that. And it'll kind of wrap around like a bolo. And then eventually those packets break open and the spores are distributed that way. So it's a little bit elevated. So the spores are more likely to be picked up in air currents and moved around.
It's just amazing.
So it's incredibly beautiful little fungus that doesn't do any harm. So if you see it, just kind of look at it and be in awe because it's that's the fungus that's making that structure. And if you want me to, I'll read that.
Please do.
Because, it's when mulching with shredded oak bark, fungal oddity, you may remark, like a tiny wren's nest where within we eggs rest. Bird's nest fungus you've seen on a lark.
How big is that? It looks like it's pretty tiny.
The size is pretty accurate in the photo, so maybe about an inch across.
Okay,
so that's pretty similar.
Sure.
And they typically occur in clusters in the mulch, so you'll see more than one of those.
Okay, great. Well, something to look forward to seeing, I'm sure. Let's go back to the phones. We have Perry in Oconto with a question. Hi, Perry.
Hello, and Brian, is there any diseases that you have to be mindful of red raspberry bushes? I had a great patch for about 15 years, and about the last three, they just slowly died out, and I don't know really what caused it.
The two diseases that I tend to see commonly on, well, the one disease I tend to see commonly on raspberries over time is Phytophthora root and crown rot. It's caused by a fungal, actually technically it's what's called a water mold, which is a fungus-like organism. It's a soil-borne organism. It produces these very long-lived resting spores, a very thick wall, so they can survive in the soil for years, if not decades. And when you're growing a plant in the same area year after year after year, you're eventually, if that organism is in the soil to start with, it could very well be, it's going to build up in terms of the amount of the organism, and then you're going to start to see your plants decline. And there's not much you can do about that other than to establish a new raspberry patch in a new location with new plants. Do not move plants from your old patch into that new area because you'll bring the pathogen with you. The other disease that I see, interestingly, I saw an example of this, and I don't see it very often, but if you ever see the tips of the branches of the canes dying back, and it looks like the infection is kind of centered around where the flowers were attached. It could be a disease called fire blight. We normally see that more commonly on apples and pears and crab apples, where it will cause a lot of branch dieback. But there's a special little variant of this bacterium that is specialized for causing the disease on raspberries. And that'll kind of cause them to kind of crook at the top, although not always, but oftentimes they will.
Okay, thank you very much, Perry. Let's do another, excuse me, limerick, Brian. Let's see, this one is 66, I believe.
Yeah,
it was kind of funny because I was reading this. I just read another book where a horse got into some bad rye and, outcome wasn't great. So anyway, talk about that one.
Yeah, so this is ergot, which is another fungal disease. We'll talk a little bit about the history. Let me read the limerick first.
Mm-hmm.
On grasses, especially rye, do maroon grains protrude by and by. Within these you'll find chems that alter the mind or with bad luck will cause you to die. And this fungus is notorious for, it infects the grain heads and invades the developing grains and converts them into a little resting structure called the sclerotium. And these are kind of dark purple in color. And the fungus actually does produce a variety of different, very interesting chemicals. Some of them are the precursors to LSD and can be quite toxic. There's some that can cause abortions, some that will cause circulatory problems, so that if you would eat this, you might eventually develop gangrene because you're not getting enough oxygen to your outer limbs. They can cause hallucinations, of course. The LSD-based ones will do that. And there's a really interesting history to this, because back in the Middle Ages, the primary grain that people were using to make bread was rye, and it's quite susceptible to this disease. So people would grow the grain, they'd have this ergot fungus in there, and they wouldn't recognize it. They'd grind up the grain into flour, bake it in the bread, and a lot of these chemicals produced by the ergot fungus aren't destroyed by heat. So they would have contaminated bread, and people would eat this and either go crazy, have hallucinations. If you eat enough of the material, it can kill you. And there were problems across medieval Europe, and the disease at that time in humans was called St. Anthony's Fire, based on the fact that one of the symptoms oftentimes was it would cause kind of a rosy discoloration to your cheeks. That was the fire. And then St. Anthony came from the fact that there was an order of monks, the Order of St. Anthony, said to set up hospitals throughout medieval Europe in order to treat people that had eaten this contaminated material. And there's some speculation that the Salem witch trials may have been due to ergot as well. They think some of the women who were accusing people of being witches and, you know, flying around may have eaten ergotized bread. And then there's some speculation that part of the reason Napoleon was not successful in invading Russia during the Napoleonic Wars was because as his army was invading Russia, it didn't help that they were doing this in the wintertime.
No.
But also, the Russians were destroying all their foodstuffs as they were retreating. And so the French army was eating off of materials they could forage off the land. And they were probably picking up grasses that were infected with the ergot fungus, and that was causing damage. And even into the 1950s, there was a little town in France called Pont-Saint-Esprit, and they got a bad batch of flour that was contaminated, baked it into bread, and they had several hundred people who suffered from ergotism because of that.
Wow, it's amazing. A teeny tiny little thing like that can cause
little
so much
fungus.
Problem. Yeah.
Interesting, though, nowadays, people will actually inoculate fields with ergot and collect the sclerotia and distill some of these chemicals from that, and they're used medicinally. So some of the chemicals, if you combine them with caffeine, you can help treat migraine headaches. Huh. Others, the ones that I mentioned that potentially can cause abortions, if you dilute those to very low concentration, if someone's having difficulty giving birth and you need to induce labor, they can be used to induce labor.
Wow, that is just amazing. Let's go back to the phones. We've got Mary and Monona with a question. Hi, Mary.
Hi. So I'm calling about my river birch trees. I have three of them that I planted about 5 years ago. Mm-hmm. And they're all the same size, but one of them that's about 50 feet from the others is yellow. Its leaves are never really fully green. And although it continues to grow, should I worry about this tree or just let it go?
If you take a look at those yellow leaves, you're probably going to notice, if you inspect them really closely, that the leaves are yellow, but the veins are distinctly dark green. And that's a very typical characteristic of a disorder called chlorosis. And it's not a true disease. It's actually a nutrient deficiency. Typically in birch trees, it's an iron deficiency in the tree. And it's not usually that we don't have enough iron in our soils. We usually have plenty of iron, but that our soil pH is overly high, which again makes a lot of sense because our underlying bedrock is limestone, which tends to cause the soil pH to go very, very high. And that locks up nutrients like iron in the soil so that the trees can't take up that nutrient. And the fact that you have other trees in your landscape that are looking fine may simply indicate that locally underneath that one particular tree, you might have a limestone boulder, or maybe the bedrock is a little bit closer to the surface, so that's modifying the soil pH. So one of the things you could do is to get a soil test into the UW Soil and Forage Lab, have them test it for the soil pH, and also ask them to test for iron content, also manganese content. That's another nutrient that potentially can induce chlorosis if there's not enough of that in the plant. That's more common, though, in red maples rather than something like birch. But oftentimes the trees will grow perfectly fine, even though they're a little bit low on iron. We see this also on oaks. In particular, pin oak is not a tree that I typically recommend in southern Wisconsin because it has a lot of chlorosis problems. So it's very common. And I do have a limerick in my book on that particular disorder. So if you want to read a little bit more.
Yeah, we won't give it them all away. You'll have to get the
book. We won't give them all away. Yeah. But again, it's something you can potentially try to correct, but it's usually by attempting to adjust the soil pH, which can be a little bit difficult to do, but it is doable.
Okay, great. Thank you for that question, Mary. Did you have a favorite limerick in the book?
I have to say there are aspects of one. There's one that I won't read on the air. It's a little bit risque.
I know which one you're talking about, but it's very funny.
But I won't read that one. But the other ones that I think I really like, there are two of them, actually. I like the one on fairy rings, and then there's also one on grain rusts that I find kind of amusing.
Okay.
So,
You can read one of those if you want.
Yeah, let's do the grain rust one, because that has some historical interesting facts to it. The Romans of old put their trust in a god who personified rust. To gain his goodwill, a red dog would they kill, so their grain harvest wasn't a bust. And there actually is a Roman god of grain rust and other agricultural diseases. He's called Robagus or Robaga, depending upon the source information that you read. And there was actually a Roman festival called Robigalia. It just was not that long ago, April 25th, mark it on your calendar.
Next year.
next year is Robigalia. And they would have a festival, usually a lot of feasting, chariot races. And then, as the limerick implies, they would sacrifice red-haired dogs to Robigus to kind of ensure that their grain harvest was good that year. And so I tell folks that, you know, you should celebrate Robigalia, but don't sacrifice dogs. I'm not advocating that. If you really want to kind of combine the dog sacrifice and the feasting, I suggest eating hot dogs.
Good. They're kind of red.
Dogs. They're kind of red, sort of. And you get the feasting in there as well. And you know, I'm not a big fan of hot dogs, so kind of sacrificing them to get them off the face of the earth is probably a good thing in my mind. We've gotten our graduate students into doing this, and they had like egg races when they did it. They just had a get together and they had hot dogs.
I love it.
Yeah.
There'll be cards next year, probably.
That's right. Well, I should design some, I suppose.
Well, there you go. Like this.
I could do that. I actually have taken the artwork and pulled that out, and I'm planning on trying to make ceramic tiles with the artwork,
which I'm hoping will be
kind of interesting.
Very much so. Well, time is winding down here, but do you have any advice for people who are trying to write their own limericks?
Just go for it. Don't be bashful about looking online or finding rhyming dictionaries or a thesaurus. I learned that from an interview by Diane Sawyer of Stephen Sondheim years ago, when she was asking him how he came up with his lyrics and found all these rhymes. And his comment was, "Do you think this just comes out of my head? No, I use rhyming dictionaries and a thesaurus." So, and then just get the patter down. And once you get the patter down and understand the kind of the rhythm of limericks, they're not that difficult to write.
Okay. Well, Stephen Sondheim said it's okay to do that.
It's okay.
Brian, thank you so much for being with us.
Welcome.
And
thank you for having me.
You bet. Thanks for writing this book. It's so much fun. We've been talking with Brian Huddleston about his book, Limerexia, a Plant Pathologist Book of Verse. Brian is director of the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic in the Department of Plant Pathology at UW-Madison. I'm Jill Nadeau, sitting in for Larry Mueller. Stay well.